Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, how can AI help us understand ourselves? If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us on science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Laura Hayes, Assistant Professor at DIAS, and Phil Smith, Physicist, Engineer, and Science Communicator. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with synthetic life, Laura.
It does indeed. And Jonathan, we've had synthetic DNA for years. And what's different now is that scientists from the University of Minnesota didn't just modify life, they built something cell-like from scratch and put that DNA in it. So they created something called a spud cell. And going back to this personal story earlier, where does the name spud cell come from? It's kind of a nod to Sputnik, the first satellite that was put into space at the start of a new frontier. But also the lead author was from Poland and said she's made of potatoes herself, so named it Sputnik. So basically what they did is they created this tiny bubble that was kind of like a membrane, so a tiny cell, added some synthetic DNA, which acts kind of like an instruction manual, and then included molecular tools, kind of like a toolkit to understand how to read that instruction manual, and created this kind of tiny bubble. So there's DNA blobs, if you like. And in the lab, these spud cells can take in supplies, they can grow, they can copy and divide, basically some of the basic processes of life. And so they're not really truly alive. Like, unlike living cells, they really still need to be kind of given things from the scientists to kind of feed and grow and things like that. But it starts to ask the question of, when does chemistry start to become life, right? We're starting from something that is chemical compounds and actually builds a cell. So previously what people have done is they've, you know, taken an already cell that we have, kind of, you know, taken it a little bit back and then added the DNA. But this is a kind of a bottom-up approach, right? We're really starting from very basic building materials and actually starting to build something that looks like life.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy around a very controversial man, a guy called Craig Venter, who first talked about creating synthetic life. And again, you know, this was a editing DNA, putting, you know, messages within a DNA and creating new DNA strands. We've seen these sort of incremental steps, but typically we're talking about editing living organisms. You're saying this cell was... It never was a human cell or a skin cell or a plant cell. This was a completely constructed mechanism that then could host sort of the mechanics of life.
Exactly, yeah. So it's basically, they have created something that basically looks like a cell and acts like a cell, dances like a cell, does it become a cell, right? So they kind of have basically a tiny bubble, fatty outer membrane that acts like the simplified cell boundary. Then the synthetic DNA that they've constructed and they've done for many years, they constructed the DNA specific to be super simple and just to do super simple stuff. This was the instruction manual, and then kind of put in these kind of molecular things that you need to basically read it. And then they weren't able to, you know, they basically had kind of other tiny little bubbles to be able to feed it. But again, not starting from a cell. But now it's starting to act like the way we would expect life to act, right? It is starting to use energy. It's starting to contain DNA. They can grow. They can divide. We've even seen some things of like simple selection, right? But it still doesn't have all the things that we expect from life, right? It does not be able to kind of create its own energy. It can't kind of respond to its own environment. So it's just a self-running factory, right? So it's kind of a demonstration of that, but we're not there yet.
In terms of the DNA, is this fully synthesized DNA or is the DNA taken from another animal?
Yeah, I think this is fully synthesized DNA specific to creating this type of cell.
So essentially what we're talking about is nearly a living thing made from just chemistry.
Yes.
Which in a way sounds crazy, right? But that is, of course, how life came about, because unless you believe in a divine creator, life must have come from chemicals, pressure and temperature. And like that to me, the idea that we all came from rocks and heat and pressure is insane.
Yeah, it really is. And I guess this study, you know, is kind of nodding to that, right? It's fundamental research to say, if we compare everything back and start with the very simplest approach, are we showing how life was formed, right? Does it just take time? And this is what life was like many, 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 many years ago before we came about. So I think this is where this study is kind of interesting and kind of going to those fundamental questions of when does chemistry become biology?
I have a conversation with my son who's, you know, studying science, and he was talking about, you know, animate and inanimate objects. And, you know, a rock is an inanimate object unless you give it a lot of time, a bit of pressure, some minerals, and then it's your grandfather. Right. Our second story, Phil, has to do with air pollution. And this is quite worrying.
Yeah, I don't know. Whoever saw this coming might have been some sort of... there's no bad joke. Well, there is. I'm sorry. Air pollution maybe jumps doing something very strange to sperm is what is happening. Which is not a sentence anyone expected to hear before breakfast. Researchers have found that men exposed to common outdoor air pollutants showed subtle changes in way the genes in their sperm were switched on and off. So not necessarily just to the fundamentals of the DNA itself, but more kind of in and around it. And I'll talk about that in a second. It's really kind of not changing the genetic code itself. It's more kind of like you've got the bad intern who's like, there's the Google Doc that's shared and they're just kind of putting notes in places that you shouldn't expect it. More of this, less of this. So really what we're looking at is a study of 2,000 men in Salt Lake City in the United States. And the men provided semen samples over several months. And researchers...
Fun.
Pardon?
Fun.
But I mean, if there's a research project you're going to get paid for, I mean, I don't want to say sign me up, but I don't have the time for that kind of thing anymore. I'm in my 40s. And the researchers estimated their exposure to outdoor pollutants during that time. And this timing, the 3 month, actually matters because sperm takes roughly 3 months to develop. And they were looking at pollutants including ozone, nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and kind of fine particulate matter. And what they've seen is the strongest links between ozone and nitrogen dioxide, where obviously you'd expect like traffic and combustion, so people out in, and about, is really contributing to these kind of things, and similar kind of stuff in vapes. Now, it was estimated, obviously, over that period of time, because you can't necessarily go have a mask on someone for that particular amount of time, but what it was affecting something called DNA methylation. And this sounds more complicated than it needs to be, but basically this is the chemical tag attached to the DNA that you kind of like, if you had a recipe for lasagna, it would be a bit going more of this, less of this, and fine tuning it. Mm. So they're finding that this exposure to pollutants is essentially changing how much the DNA is acting as it gets to the next stage.
Now, because it's not changing DNA, so to speak, it's probably not necessarily being inherited, but these changes, do they have an effect on fertility? Do we know that changes in epigenetics or DNA methylation actually has an effect on the fertility of a person?
Well, this is actually, the reason why we should care, and particularly in and around, obviously, the fertility is often considered just a women's health issue as opposed to a men's one, and changing the construct around pollution, not just affecting, you know, everything, breathing, everything, it's actually affecting what the next generation might come through. So they are suggesting that this is actually helping. It's not with sperm just looking but how they swim and like how much of motility they have and how many of them there are, but it's also the messages and how they convey it. So they are suggesting that this is something that is having a knock-on effect in terms of those messages going into what that your offspring are going to have in terms of the traits and personalities related to that DNA strand. The big takeaway is that this isn't a panic story or a blame story. It's not men that your sperm is doomed. There are other things in contributing factors to this as well, but it is something to consider that maybe if you're out cycling or you're out in traffic, it's another reason to get rid of those pollution and from cars down.
Very good. Third story, Laura, has to do with contact.
It does. And it kind of ties back philosophically into the previous story, right? What happens if we create the synthetic life and it goes into our ecosystem? But what happens if we go out to space and we bring back extraterrestrial life and it impacts our ecosystem? So this story is basically a new policy proposal that has been proposed by researchers at McGill University. Basically being like, if we start to have extraterrestrial samples, so samples from Mars or from the icy moons of Jupiter, for example, and we're trying to bring them back to Earth, should we bring them directly back to Earth, right? Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should think about what happens when we do find life and we bring it back and it actually disrupts our ecosystem. Really something like out of sci-fi. So this whole policy proposal is really to think about maybe we should build a quarantine facility on the moon, right? So it's outside the biosphere of Earth, but it's nearby. And maybe this can lean in where we can put something there. We can quarantine it. We can test it. before we bring it back into our bioecosystem, right? This makes sense. And it's not just really science fiction. We're living in a space exploration era of sample return missions, right? We have the Mars sample return mission that is both the NASA and European Space Agency mission that's planning to go and collect the samples that Perseverance on Mars has been looking in a big lake on Mars where we think there is life. You know, we're thinking about NASA's Europa mission, that's Europa Clipper mission, that's going to Europa to try and see if there's signatures of life there. So it's really this idea that having a biological firewall for anything we might think about coming back to Earth in the near future.
This is the premise of a lot of sci-fi films, mm-hmm. and it does not go well. But the chances of finding anything and that thing being dangerous are really, really ridiculously small, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. It's not that, you know, a little green man's going to climb into your sample and come here and jump out and, you know, kill us all. I think it's more, we just don't know what's going to happen, right? Maybe the DNA is different. Maybe there's something different that can impact the tiniest structures of cells that we have. And maybe it would be okay, but is it something that you really want to risk? Like, it's totally unknown, right? We're still in an era where maybe there isn't life out there. I think there definitely is, but maybe there isn't. But
where is it, Laura?
Where is it? I'm trying to find it. No, I don't know. I think in, you know, wouldn't be surprised in our lifetime we find signatures, right? It's not, again, a little green man, but signatures of life somewhere else in our solar system or in the wider space. And, you know, thinking about quarantining, you know, this isn't a new concept. The Apollo missions, when those astronauts came back, they themselves were quarantined for 3 weeks, along with all the moon rocks that were brought back. And now I think it's more like we're going to places where there could be life, where we're looking for life, that maybe we should think about maybe having a facility on the moon in the future.
Now, it would be kind of cool. I'm going to go to the quarantine facility on the moon to check out, you know, those alien samples we got on Mars. That's pretty cool. Our final story, Phil, has to do with streetlights.
Streetlights. Yeah, I do feel like there is a musical number that we should be doing. And it's something wonderfully strange happening underneath streetlights. Now, not necessarily with something sexy and cool that we would imagine. Isopods. So basically think wood lice. I've been seeing gathering in huge circular groups at night. And that sounds like a headline of some tabloid that we need to stop these guys loitering around and causing issues. But it's not just a few of them. It's thousands of them. And they're moving around in circles at the edge of white light. It looks like something that's kind of like an organized armored little traffic jam. Because they're always look like prawns with medieval helmets on. There is a serious side to this, though, because these spirals could leave these little animals exposed and easier for predators to pick off, in terms of they're almost hypnotized by these lights. So research is coming out of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. It is looking at kind of these armadillo sordidus, and they're land-dwelling isopods. So you'd, like I said, think woodlice, pill pugs, or someone calls them roly-polies. I don't know if anyone ever calls them that anymore. No, just me, old. They're kind of tiny, damp engineers. So they work in damp, dark spaces. You go in your garden and you lift a log and you see loads of them around. But they're really good at eating and making stuff decay around and like taking care of them. They're really part of a system. And what's really interesting about this is they saw this happening in these lights.
They were just being covered by these lice.
Yeah, but in moving in a circle. And like, firstly, you'd see like one coming along, then a few, and then literally thousands. And it's almost like following instructions.
On the ground or on the light?
On the ground, on the light, following where the light would shine down onto the ground. Oh, and you're seeing it going around, particularly around the edge. And they were trying to figure out what's going on. Could it be magnetism? No. Ultraviolet light? Not really. So it's tighter white light. And this is where it really seems interesting, because often when we think of light pollution, we think of birds, we think of things that are kind of obvious to us. We never kind of think of this small part of a big food chain. Mm. And we need to pay accurate attention to all kind of elements of this, why it might be happening.
But do they know why it's happening?
So it's particularly this white light where they're looking at. It's almost like one, it's like they're following the leader, essentially, is what they say. One will follow and get followed the edge of this. Like when you draw a black line around with ants and then they'll never get outside that line again. So it seems this large group behavior, like schools of fish, flocks of birds, that kind of thing.
Or chickens. Have you ever seen those videos about chickens?
Yes, that's mad.
You have a chicken and then you draw a line in the sand and they'll just get stuck. And if you put their beak down to the line and draw a line in front of their beak and then just take your hand off, they just stay. Mad.
Have you got thousands of chickens?
I think that's a real thing. I think that's not AI. I think that is a real thing. You can let me know. Guys, thank you very much. All right, on the way, exactly how bad is sitting down? Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, sitting for more than 30 minutes at a time without movement may be linked to a higher risk of cancer-related death, according to new research. Even light activity, like walking, housework, or even standing up briefly, is associated with lower risk when it replaced prolonged inactivity. We're joined by Dr. Frederick Ho now from the University of Glasgow, who led the study. Welcome to the program, Frederick. For starters, this is not the idea that, you know, sitting around all the time is a bad idea. This is not a particularly new idea.
Hi, and no, exactly. It's not a very new idea. We have a lot of evidence showing sitting for a long time to be associated with all sorts of diseases, cardiovascular diseases mainly. But what we found that is new is that not just the total time of sitting, but also how we sit or what is the duration of one sitting also matters.
So how do we define sitting then? I know that sounds like a really stupid question, but often these questions lead to kind of interesting answers. When you're asking people about sitting or you're measuring someone while they're sitting, I mean, what counts? Is it just sitting upright? Is it slouching backwards? You know, if someone is leaning on a desk, does that count as sitting?
That's a great question, actually. And that also tells one of the novelty of our study. And I think in 10, 20 years ago, we have some initial evidence on sitting is bad. And that was mainly based on questionnaire, people just being asked how they spend their time watching TV or driving or sitting in front of your computer doing work. So that was the old way. So right now we have variables or a way to measure actual movement based on device in our wrist, like a smartwatch, that kind of thing. And so basically we use these signals from the watch to see whether a person is sedentary, which is a more technically accurate wording. Basically, they're not moving much. And that's how we define sitting, because to be honest, there's very rarely people will be standing for an hour not moving at all.
Uh-huh. So we're talking about not moving. So you could be slouched, you could be sitting, you could be lying down on a bed watching TV. This all counts as being sedentary, and this for long periods of time when you're not resting, like when you're not sleeping, this we know leads to increased morbidity, cancer risk, and lots of other things. Can I ask, how do we separate those who are more likely to sit more because they're unwell from the morbidity risk? So if I'm already unwell, I'm much more likely to be sedentary, and therefore I'm much more likely to have these health complications. But it might also be the fact that I have these health complications and that's why I'm sedentary.
We have looked at a list of long-term conditions that might impact people's mobility. For example, whether they have disability, whether they have any severe long-term conditions. We excluded people with those conditions. We also excluded people with long-standing illnesses, and we are controlling for people's other lifestyle, diets, and other things. So it would not be as good as doing an experiment, but it's very close to being that.
Okay, so let's talk about the data you've collected, because it's a really significant amount of data. What did you gather, for how long, and who took part in the study?
I have acknowledged that this is not a study that we collected data primarily. It's based on a study called UK Biobank. It's a massive data bank based funded by a lot of charities and governments. And
right.
Okay. We are using the data. Yeah. We are just using the data from UK Biobank, and they recruited 500,000 of people across UK. And then among these people, a subgroup, about 90,000 were given a variable. So they wore it for 7 days. And those 7 days movement were captured in the activity monitor. And then their health records was linked to the NHS in the UK. And then we can ascertain whether they have any cancer diagnosis or whether they die in the middle of the follow-up, so that we can do the statistical analysis to find out whether there's an association.
And then you look at health outcomes. What have you found when it comes to staying still, watching TV, not moving? What have you found about how that affects our health?
So firstly, we replicated what people have found, and total sedentary time to be associated with higher cancer risk. And that's not surprising, but it's also reassuring that our data is consistent with what we have known. And then we have split the sedentary time into two mutually exclusive parts. The first one is what we call prolonged sedentary time, which is defined as sitting or being still for at least 30 minutes. And then we also looked at sedentary time that are in smaller chunks, less than 30 minutes. And what we found was contrasting results between these two new concepts. People with higher prolonged sedentary time to be have a higher cancer risk, and people with a higher interruptive sedentary time, that is sedentary time with less than 30 minutes, are having lower cancer risks.
Okay, so one of the things that I always try to dig into is the numbers, because relative risk versus actual risk is slightly different, right? So someone might have an increase of 100% on a cancer that is only in 0.1% of the population. That's only 0.2% of the population. When we talk about cancer risk, are we talking about overall cancer risk, any type of cancer? And if so, how much does your risk of cancer increase per 30 minutes of sitting around doing sod-all?
That's a great question. So we did only look at relative risk because we use UK Biobank, and it's quite selective sample. People are in this data are actually quite affluent. And so it could not represent UK and could not represent other places of the world. And what we found was we looked at a list of cancer outcomes. So the primary outcome that we looked at is mortality from cancer. And actually what we found was that about 10 to 20% of high risk for 30 minutes of prolonged sedentary time.
Say again?
What we found was about 10 to 20% of higher cancer mortality risk for every hour of prolonged sedentary time.
So if I'm sitting watching a movie that's like 2 hours long, which most films are now, I'm increasing my higher cancer risk by how much? I mean, that's obviously not just a single movie, but if that is something that I do every single day, I'm increasing my chance of higher risk mortality, dying from cancer, by up to 20%?
Yes, but have to note that it's accounting for a whole range of the sedentary time. So it's not exactly a linear relationship, meaning that if your overall sedentary time is only 2 hours per day, increasing by 2 hours might not matter much. But if your overall sedentary time is already 6 hours, increasing 2 hours might get you in a much higher range. And the number I quote at 10 to 20% is an average across the range. So it's really dependent on how sedentary you are.
Right. But I mean, like, we think about both, you know, I'm thinking about my own household. My son plays video games, watches TV, is on his phone. Now, he does a lot of other stuff, but he plays music, he plays football, but he spends a lot of time not moving. But he's young and extremely fit. Do you have data on younger people, or is this tend to look at people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s? I mean, do we know what sedentary lifestyle for a child might be if they're generally fit and healthy?
We don't have data for children and adolescents. What we have for data is for middle age from 40 years old. And so the number would probably be smaller, weaker. The relationship would be weaker for younger people.
So the data which should suggest what, if we want to significantly reduce our cancer risk, that we jump up and down every 30 minutes, or we just don't stay still? What's a reasonable middle point here?
So first of all, the 30 minutes mark is really arbitrary. It's something that we try to operationalize our analysis, and that is not like a gold standard of how we should partition our time. But what we found is if we can interrupt our sedentary time for, say, 10% of the being sitting, say if we are going to have a 2-hour movie, for example, if we can have a walk for 12 minutes before or after the movie, that will already make it less like a prolonged sedentary time. That could kind of nullify the relationship.
It's really, I mean, we knew it was bad, but that was a lot of self-reporting. It's great to see, you know, proper data that says sitting still or just not moving, lounging around and doing very little is something that we need to think about as a society, particularly as devices become smaller and more convenient. Very interesting speaking with you. Frederick Ho is from the University of Glasgow and he led the study. Thanks, Frederick. That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Micheál O'Connell for producing. Rory Galvin was on podcast. Stephen McLean was on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Tuesday in your podcast feed. Have a great Sunday.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.